episode 68 of the Planning Period Podcast. You're at Break Room. I'm your host, Brad Scheffler. This week on the show, I'm joined by Dr. Bob Walker. Bob and I work together at the school I joined this year, and he is our academic dean. He's also a really well-read and learned educator with great ideas. He and I regularly have fascinating conversation on ideas in our field, and I knew he would be a great guest on our show. Bob and I talk about being inclusive with all students, the power of a gay-straight alliance on campus, how we don't value education nationally, problems with educational policy leading to issues in testing and hiring, how we as educators can help get the word out, as it were, restorative practices, restorative justice, and how they're used, and he pretty hardcore brown-noses our boss. So, sit back and enjoy episode 68 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Dr. Bob Walker. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Brad Scheffler. I am doing a face-to-face interview today for the first time in a really long time, actually. I feel like it's been a while since I've done face-to-face. It's probably been since this summer. And I'm getting to sit down with someone who I work with every day and who is at the new school I've been joined. That was terrible English to get us kicking off to start this event off with. But I'm joined today by Dr. Bob Walker. How you doing today, man?
I'm doing well, sir. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm excited. You know, we've been talking about doing this for a few months now, and just the scheduling hasn't lined up, and it's been a pain, and now we're finally getting to it, so it's good.
It is. It's almost like we both work at a really busy school every day and don't have a lot of free time. It's strange.
I don't know what you're talking about. We have tons of free time. I mean, just today, we were cooking hot dogs outside, so.
Very true.
But we weren't. Other people were, and we were eating hot dogs.
Well, you were. I was in a meeting. I did not get a hot dog. It was criminal what happened. Didn't even get a hot dog.
That is not fair. They really should have scheduled that better. For my audience who do not know you, who are you, sir?
Well, that's a very existential question.
I try.
Who is any of us, or who are any of us, I guess? Well, I'm, as you said, Dr. Bob Walker. I'm the academic dean here at Bridgewater Middle School. This is my 14th year. Working in education, started out teaching high school, was a graduate fellow at Virginia Tech for a spell, taught at the university level for many years, came back to public K-12 for a while after a short stint working with at-risk youth in a DJJ program. recently completed my doctorate at UCF. Go Knights.
National champs.
I don't know about that, but that's all right. And recently moved over here to middle school about a year ago after being in high school, moved out of the classroom. This is my third or fourth year as academic support staff outside the classroom.
So what is kind of, you've taken a path. I mean, you've been a lot of places.
I've been all over the place.
Let's start with now. What does your role now really consist of?
Sure. well, I do a little of this and that. I work with coaching. I work with our MTSS program. I work with our PLCs. And I
just,
provide.
You're basically just an acronym master.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Anything that's got an acronym or a program, hey, I'm just trying to fluff up that resume. Whatever our API needs and, you know, as always, as they say, other duties is assigned, which, you know, some days includes mopping hallways, sometimes pushing cars that have died in the parking lot. And last week it included pulling a tree that had fallen into the road out of the road. So you just never know.
You really don't. You really don't. I have never struggled with the other duties as assigned. Or I shouldn't say struggled, but I've never been hit so strong by the other duties as assigned as I have been since I've joined this school. Which is, I think, just a function of the size of what we do here.
I don't know what you're talking about. This is a tiny little middle school. We just got a handful of children here, and you know, only a few portables. It's a tiny operation. I believe only the largest in the state of Florida.
Yeah, only the largest, and I'm sure of many other states as well. I don't know that we have the data to support that yet, but
I think
we've
that's a fair assumption.
It's gotta be. It's funny. I do, you know, like I said, I do a lot of interviews from people all over the world, and so many times they're like, oh yeah, we're at a pretty big school, we've got like 400 students, and I'm like, oh, that's cute. We've got that in our gym in second period.
Like, I would say we have more than double that at each lunch period.
Yes, so. Exactly. So it is it's an interesting experience.
From all the things you have done, I would like to assume you enjoy what you're doing now, obviously, but what has been kind of your favorite role other than this? I will exclude this for to ensure we hurt no one's feelings.
Sure. So I've been very fortunate over the course of my career to have some amazing moments and experiences. It's a struggle to pick out, any one, but if I had to, there's probably two. I got to teach dual enrollment at the high school, so with high school students, but they're on the campus. And so getting to teach young people that were intentionally challenging themselves was really cool. And then I worked for a while with a program called Pace Center for Girls. It's a DJJ program. Our partners with DJJ.
What is the DJJ?
Department of Juvenile Justice.
Okay, just making sure.
They do diversion, and so a lot of the students there have been involved with the legal system in one way or the other. Very challenging work. I was only there for about 2 years, but very impactful on my life and how I approach working with young people.
Before we get to my normal questions, I did want to, and I didn't clear this with you, so if you don't want to talk about it, too bad. You let me turn a mic on. I wanted to talk about, there is one program you run here that I'm really proud of, and I know that our school is proud of as well. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the Pride Club that you're involved with. I feel like we're in a moment in our culture, mm-hmm. outside of education, where many people are talking about acceptance and being more open-minded and accepting of other people. And I feel like it's one of the few cases where schools are actually involved, education is actually involved on the forefront of a social issue. Because I think usually we wait for social issues to be over and dealt with before we try to get involved. But I feel like it's one of those rare cases where we are kind of on the forefront. And I feel like you are even of the forefront of that as you run that Pride Club, and it's something that our school is proud of.
Sure. Well, I'll talk to you a little bit from it, from kind of logistics of what we do and kind of more the theoretical of why we do as well. Logistically, I came over here, as you know, with our principal. We were meeting with some students early on when we first got here that came with a variety of idea of clubs and activities they would like to see. And they mentioned a Pride Club or GSA, Gay Straight Alliance, as they're more commonly referred to. And they mentioned a story of a student that had come out as transgender at an event they were having the year prior and felt that that would be great to have something to support that student. Mr. Jackson and I did our due diligence because we both said, wow, this is a middle school. We don't know how that plays with middle schoolers. I'd known from some of my law classes that some other districts have really shied away from that to the point of getting rid of all activities at middle schools and things. So we reached out. We were very fortunate and pleased to find out that our district is very supportive. And so we sought out a teacher to sponsor the club. We had somebody, and for whatever reason, it never quite got started. And so it was around October-ish time frame, maybe November. And I was talking with Mr. Jackson. I said, it hasn't started. Some kids have asked. And so I said, I'm willing to just take it on. I'll sponsor the club. And so we started. And because so many kids had been asking for it, we initially started. We had about 30 kids as members right out of the gate. I mean, I was blown away by the response that we had. And kind of just, like I said, the theoretical or the research base, anybody that looks into knows that LGBTQ youth are at higher risk for suicide, runaway, a lot of negative experiences. And the research out there shows that if they have some community, be it at school or, in the surrounding community, where they can feel safe and accepted, that lowers those rates. Interesting study came out recently out of Canada that actually found having a GSA at a school reduces rates of suicide among all students at the school and showed a benefit across the whole campus. So there's a lot of research and literature out there about it. So that's kind of supports why we do what we do. And just on a personal level, it's cool to see the positive impact on these kids and their sense of community. We were fortunate to recently take part in the Orlando Pride Parade. We required the kids to bring a parent. So for some of the parents, it was their first Pride Festival, and for obviously for most of the kids. And so to facilitate that kind of marquee life event in the lives of those parents and their kids was really a cool thing. And to see them walk in a parade, together. And I was very fortunate my mom, came as well. So I, you know, the students thought that was pretty neat that, my mom was there as well as their
parents. The members had to bring a parent. So you followed the rules as you were told to.
Yes, sir. I did. I followed the rules. And so it's been a really, wonderful thing to be a part of. And, you know, we've not been without struggles. You know, we've had kids taking down signs and things of that nature. But, I truly believe the presence of the club and just having that conversation is, powerful and important for the young people.
So I want to ask, cause I think, I mean, yes, mm-hmm. the research is out there. We understand that having a GSA or a GSA affiliated group is something, or just an accepting place is valuable. But when I was, even before I got here and I was hearing about all this from a distance, in my head I'm going, wow, the parents must love that one. Like, I just am imagining that it's getting some pushback. There is some pushback, and I don't want to focus on mm-hmm. the pushback itself, because I don't want to give voice to that.
Sure.
I'm more interested in how do you address some of that pushback? What is your reply to an angry parent who feels that this is some sort of a negative for the school?
I've been fortunate that a lot of the angry things have not come directly to me. So some of the pushback has gone to the district level or to the principal. And as I said before, the district is very supportive. We have a strong non-discrimination policy in the district that covers our club. And so far, the biggest pushback that I'm aware of is actually our club t-shirts that we make and sell that have sold very well among faculty and staff to the point that I was shocked. I mean, we first made the shirt and had them designed intent only to sell them to the students that were in the club. And because they are very colorful and print on both sides, they came out to be a very expensive shirt. And so we looked at how to get the cost down was to sell more. And so the principal said, you know, why don't you send out an email and see if there's any interest in staff. And we needed to sell something like 10 more to get the price down, and we sold like 40 more.
I still owe you like $20 for my shirt. Note to self.
That is an accurate statement. You are on the list, sir. So we've sold, and we've had some pushback that the perception on some people was that the school was giving those shirts out for free as some kind of endorsement. I believe one of the exact wordings was of the homosexual agenda. And that kind of thing. So that does happen.
Do you guys also make agendas? That would be cool. You could make planners. Then you could actually sell the homosexual agenda.
That would actually be a hilarious fundraiser. I'm not going to open that can of worms because we would literally then have to sell, defend selling the homosexual agenda. And I could only imagine the headlines that would come out of that. But, and I say it all the time to people when they ask about, we have a club at a middle school, and we were not by any means the first in Oldham County. We are currently the only. They're really the heyday of the GSA was late 90s, early 2000s, and they kind of went away for a while. And we're starting to see a return. And interestingly enough, if you look at the research and literature, there's several annual big studies that have seen the decline in incidents and rates of bullying of LGBTQ students. Every year it's gone down. And the report, the study that came out for the 2017-2018 school year, is the first year we've seen that trend stop. And then some metrics go back up. So I think there's, as you said earlier, a cultural moment we find ourselves in, where this is again relevant as it was before. So these clubs are starting to come back as students look for safe places in community. I say it all the time, I'm amazed that we have not gotten more negative pushback. I don't worry about it, or at least I try not to, because I think, again, there's research that supports that what we're doing is positive for the kids. And it's open to anybody. Students who identify as LGBTQ or students who just want to make sure the campus is inclusive. And I think what is really cool to me about it is the kids that first approached us with the idea were there to support another student who was a friend of theirs. They've never joined the club. They don't identify as LGBTQ. But they wanted that student to have a safe space. And so it's very powerful.
Yeah, it's, you know, I've, again, in my limited time here, I feel like I've seen the benefits of some of it, and I think it's just great. I think, you know, marching in the Pride Parade, I thought, was a very cool thing. I don't think many people would have taken that on. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really powerful. And the other thing I think it's important is recognizing that having a club like this does not mean that you're just finding mm-hmm. all of the LGBTQ kids and putting them in a group. It's finding kids that are supportive of mm-hmm. other people. Like the goal of the club is not to make other people LGBTQ. I think that's when people say like, oh, you're selling a homosexual agenda. I think that's what they mean is like, our goal is just to make everybody mm-hmm. gay. Like, and no, it's not. That's not at all. Like at the end of the day, it's about inclusivity. It's mm-hmm. about accepting other people for who they are. And I think that's just a really powerful thing. And like you said, giving students a space where they can be mm-hmm. accepted is so powerful and so useful in a million different ways. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think it's just really good. I think it's a great thing that you are doing and that the school is doing as well.
Thank you. And like I said, I'm honored to run it, but I give a lot of credit to our principal, because I don't think there are a lot of principals that would have walked in the parade with a group. I don't know of any others. And so for me, and I reached out to so many friends afterwards, as I said, can you believe my principal of the middle school where I worked walked in the local Pride Parade with kids from our school and their parents mm-hmm. and had his wife there with him and some other folks from school. And so I think that was tremendously powerful and signified his commitment to a school that is truly safe and welcoming of all students. And that's just a really, it's a good thing to be a part of.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree completely. I feel like we could probably wax poetic all day about how much we love some of the leadership here. Just brought both of us here in the last couple of years. So
very true.
But I do want to get to my typical questions because I think we can have a pretty lively discussion here about some of these. So, I do want to get to my main questions, and I also want to tell you I'm going to then design the homosexual agenda for you. I'm gonna do that for you so that you can make that decision to sell it later.
I do want you to know that anything for the homosexual agenda, there's a whole approval process.
Okay.
It does have to go through the gay mafia. There's okay. a whole thing.
There's a whole thing. Okay.
I don't know if you're sure.
I just want to do the graphic design work. Yeah. I don't really care what you put inside of it. I just want to design the cover. That's really the only part that matters.
I don't care what you put inside it. That was a loaded statement. We're gonna move on.
Moving on. So my first question for all my guests is, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
Oh, wow. That's, I mean, I think there's so many layers, to that. And, you know, nationally, I think is one conversation. And I think, excuse me, I'm gonna get a little water. Nationally, I think when we look at it, the biggest issue, I think, is just how we value education. And I don't think we value education, both educators and just the value of knowledge, the same as we once did, in the way we do in some other countries. So I think that's a national, issue, more particular to Florida where we're at and that I have, you know, a little bit more of an investment in. I just think we've had some wrong-headed policy that mimics some of the national. I think, you know, we've really, starting with A Nation at Risk in the 80s, kind of got really obsessed with testing and accountability. And we've gone down that road for quite a while, really, with, you know, No Child Left Behind in early 2000s, really investing heavily in that. And we've gone far enough down the road now that we've got a substantial body of data that shows that that hasn't borne a lot of fruit. We haven't seen quality of education improving, but we're continuing to invest a lot of money in it. And so we're kind of at the point now where I look at it as, you know, someone in a casino gambling, and you keep doubling down and losing, but you kind of refuse to admit defeat, and realize that the path we chose just isn't the right one and isn't working. And so I think that if I had to pick one biggest problem, it's that emphasis on we've got to test to make sure that teachers are teaching. Rather, I think, you know, I say sometimes we put the quality control of teachers on the back end rather than making sure we hire really great people we kind of hire just darn near anybody and then test the kids to make sure that the teachers are worth anything. And most other industries and professions don't really operate that way. So I think that mindset of how we, the testing, the accountability, and how we go about hiring people into the profession, which I guess is honestly two things, but I look at them as very closely related. If I had to say one thing, that's where I would go.
Okay. Yeah, I see your point. I think the connection I would draw that if we are not investing so much into the tests being written, and I think that's what a lot of people don't realize, non-educators especially, I don't think realize how expensive testing is. And cost to taxpayers is astronomical. So if we're saving that money on that investment, mm-hmm. then we're able to reinforce the pay of teachers at the very least, which would encourage more people to take the profession on.
If we look at the testing industry, I apologize, cutting you off, is a, over the last couple of decades, the growth is in profits is more than like 500%. It's staggering. I mean, I wish I had a time machine. I could go back. I'd buy stock in it. I'd feel dirty for owning it today.
Invest in Pearson all day, man.
But I would also be on a beach somewhere in the tropics drinking a pina colada. Because it's, as you said, it's enormous. It's staggering amounts of money that are going into that. I saw something that said the only thing that makes more was something like the National Football League and something like there's a few other industries that make more that draw taxpayer money to go into their services. So it's out there.
Yeah. So I think if we fix that, if we stop investing that amount of money and we put it into teacher pay as a simple solution, we would fix a lot of problems. There'd be a lot more people looking for these jobs and we wouldn't have to hire darn near everybody and we wouldn't need to overtest the kids just to prove we'd hired the right people. So I think I see that connection there. What I'm interested in your response is you said that it's wrong-headed policy. And I want to dissect that a little bit. And so in your mind, is it wrong-headed or misguided? Or so when you say wrong-headed, do you mean misguided or do you feel there is some nefarious or intent behind it as well?
I always think anything there's a measure of both. You always got to look where's the money going? And I do think in our state, there are some folks who have some ties to things that make money who tend to support policy that makes money for those things, which in turn puts money in their pot. You know, it's one of those little ecosystems. And I think sometimes their votes are informed as much by those ecosystems as they are by what the data shows us is best for kids. So I think there is some level of nefariousness. I also try to be an optimist. And I do think that by and large, a lot of the things that happen is people just don't know. A lot of people don't have school age kids. They're not impacted directly. So I think there's some, policy that's allowed to happen and going on that people just aren't informed when they vote for these folks, and then people are allowed to continue making policy that just is not the best.
I don't know that at an individual level we can fight bad policymakers. Certainly we could look at the options of ourselves running for office and look at going into the political game, but again, that's now completely leaving our field and doing something else entirely different. And you know, I don't know, from what I hear, it takes a lot of money to be a politician, and I don't know about you, but I'm a teacher. I know you got that nice $8 raise when you got your doctorate, but I did not.
Was, yeah, $8 a paycheck, something like that.
I did not get that raise, so you can put your $8 towards running for office. I can't. But I think what you address there is people not knowing. And I think even parents of school-age children don't have the understanding of what we do in a school. Would you agree with that, first of all? Do you think that even parents lack that information?
Oh, most definitely. I think, you know, most parents send their kids to school, assume their kids getting a good education, and if nothing out of the ordinary happens to call their attention to the school or to require them to pay more mind, they don't, because they're busy working and doing other things. So I imagine, you know, most folks assume what's supposed to happen at school is happening.
So then my question is, is that the point where we could actually be addressing at a school level? And I know that we are obviously encumbered by the limitations of what we are and are not allowed to say by the powers that be above us. You know, our district makes its own decisions about what we can and can't say. But is there something we could be doing either individually as teachers, because you got to remember my audience is a lot of teachers. So as individual teachers, could we be doing something more, or as a school, could we be doing something more?
Sure. I struggle to look at it from an as a school perspective, because I think when we get into the political realm and things, I tend to look at it as private citizens. I think, you know, once policy is made, we as a school need to operate in adhering to that in the best way we can and in the best interest of kids. And that's a separate kind of mission. To me, when I walk into the school, it's about the kids. But I think in the other rest of our lives, educators, there's an obligation to speak to people. You know, let people know the information you have. It reminds me of, in this, go back to our Pride Club topic earlier, that, the famous, gay civil rights, activist, I guess you could call him, Harvey Milk, said, you know, if we come out, if people know you and realize that they know someone who is gay or lesbian, they tend to not vote against things that are horrible for gay and lesbian people. and I apply that same logic. If people realize the negative impacts policies are having on educators who educate their kids or their neighbor's kids or the kids in their neighborhood or their grandbabies or what have you, I think when people are made aware, they make better, more informed decisions. So I think as educators, we have a moral imperative, if you will, to be honest with people and share information that we know that most people don't care about because they're not educators. It doesn't directly impact their daily lives. So that to me is how I always approach it.
Cool. Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Sounds like you're advocating everyone getting arguments on Facebook as teachers and just go out and spout your opinion to all your friends on Facebook. I think that's sounds like a solution. I was on a thread today on Twitter about like social media and negativity, and this just popped into my head as you said that. But I agree. It is not everyone's favorite dinner party conversation, but I will often have that conversation in mixed company where it is not educators, and I will regularly talk about, no, you don't understand the things that are happening in a school. And even if you have kids, you don't actually understand the things that are happening at a school. And these policy decisions, you know, when the merit pay stuff first came out, from a business standpoint, I get the logic behind it, but that's not how education works. and so I think that those are the conversations we need to have. I use that as an example only because when I had conversations with my non-educator friends and explained, I get that. I was in business. Mm-hmm. I understand what you were saying. Yes, I should be judged on the number of sales I make if I sell widgets. Mm-hmm. I don't sell widgets. I deal with people.
the sad thing though is that mentality of measuring is now flowing upstream into the university systems, such that some professors in their tenure reviews, they're now looking at the employment status of your recent graduates, which, you know, I had a professor that is a professor of creative writing. And she said, you know, most of my students don't really go into lucrative fields with a degree in creative writing, you know. So it unfairly is biased towards your, you know, business professors or pre-law folks are going to look like they're phenomenal. And your liberal arts people are going to look like they're doing nothing good for the world because their graduates go out and, you know, decide to become high school teachers and make $40,000 a year. Mm-hmm. And the business kid goes out and is making $60,000. But that's how some
occasionally the business kid goes into education and makes $40,000 a year. So I can't speak for everybody, but that was my experience.
Well, I was also not an education major, so I understand. I was an English major, and that, which is terribly lucrative, which is why I'm here today.
Exactly. All right. Well, I don't know that we have a solution, but I think at the very least we should be out having those conversations. Certainly something I've advocated for through my work before. Mm-hmm. So I can get behind that. I can support that completely. My next question, I'm going to go to my next one. My next question for you is, what is something you're doing that you wish everyone was doing, you wish all educators were doing?
gosh, that's hard because that, you know, I think the biggest thing everybody's got to do, what's right for them. A big thing, I believe, it being honest, be real, be authentic, build relationships. That's such a catchphrase here at the school we work. I'm a firm believer in restorative practices. Honestly, the more I think about it, if I had to pick one thing, it would be learning about and getting involved in restorative practices. I think as they've rolled out, a lot of people have looked at it as simply a discipline piece and how to change school discipline. And I look at it more as how to change school culture and looking at schools as a community of people who need to coexist and work together to support each other and become a family in a sort of way. And that's very, very important to me in that relationship building piece. The hardest thing for me since leaving the classroom these last couple of years is missing that community that I had with my students in the classroom. And now my community is predominantly other adults, which is, you know, very different and it, not bad, but to be honest, they're not as much fun as my students. You know, they don't want to necessarily learn things from you. They want to tell you what they already know. Whereas your kids are usually a little more receptive and, they're there to get knowledge from me. And if you stimulate them with good ideas and challenge them, it becomes a very exciting thing. Whereas adults tend to be a little more ornery and resistant. So it's a very different experience and I miss that community. So I think if there's one thing I hope every teacher is doing is getting to know their students, building relationships. There was a great quote that was floating around Facebook for a while that said, you know, be the adult you needed in your life at that age. You know, really just you know, be good people for the kids. Try to challenge them. Try to help them learn, build that community.
Yeah, I like that. You know, and I think you hit on a key point there with restorative practices, because I think we often look at restorative justice, as, mm-hmm. which is a component of that, and we do look at it from the discipline perspective. I think it's one of the problems with restorative practices is that so many people look at mm-hmm. it for the discipline component, and that discipline component doesn't work without the other parts. Mm-hmm. From the limited information I know on restorative practices, that doesn't work without the culture shifting component. Mm-hmm. Could you talk briefly for my audience that doesn't have a clue what you're talking about what restorative practices look like in your version of things?
Sure. First, just to say, I think what you're hitting on with the discipline, though, is that, you know, a lot of times big, high level decision makers, they're looking for numbers, things that are going to move, data, which I think is all, well intended. But with restorative practices, you know, if you're starting with the idea in mind of changing numbers, you're missing the point. And really, what restorative practices looks like to me, as I said, is building that relationship in that community. And so the conversation becomes, rather than a punitive or you broke a rule, the conversation becomes you damaged this community in some way. And now our community is no longer whole. And what are you going to do to fix that? It's talking using effective statements. You know, I feel anxious when you stand on your desk, right? Because it might fall over. And I appreciate if you didn't do that, Johnny. So rather than just telling Johnny, you know, stand on your desk is against the rules. If you do it again, I'm going to send you to the dean's office, right? It's getting that student to understand the impact they're having on the other people in the room. And so that to me is kind of the paradigm shift. It becomes you're having conversations with kids instead of talking at them. And I think that's important, you know, at the high school level, definitely. You try to talk at high schoolers all day, they're going to talk right back at you. And no one's really listening to anybody. But I even think with the younger kids, middle schoolers, even elementary kids, it's helping them develop some important life skills, and we get into that social-emotional learning where they're becoming aware of how they impact other people. Because we know we've worked with people, I'm sure anybody has, that you go through life, you go, is that person just emotionally tone-deaf? Like they're constantly going around offending everybody or just being a brute in some kind of way. And so I think it's important for those kids to develop those skills. So, and then there's, you know, very practical aspects of restorative practice. A lot of people think of the circles, in getting those kids into circles to have conversations. I value the circles, but I think that's just one piece. That's one way to implement and build that community. That is certainly not restorative practices in their totality. So I would encourage anybody out there who's listening and saying restorative practices, I've never heard about it. There's the IIRP, which is the International Institute for Restorative Practices. They do conferences. They have a lot of material out there. Google them. They're great. There's the River Phoenix. I believe it's the River Phoenix Center for Peace Building here in Florida. There's the Florida Restorative Justice Association. So there's a lot of great national, international, local organizations involved. Google them, get some information. It really is a powerful tool to shape how you interact with kids.
And links to all three of those will be in the show notes. Of course, you can slide on over and grab those. You got to click the buttons. Makes it super easy. You forget you're on a podcast, right?
Yeah.
I have to remind myself, like, of course, on the podcast, don't see Bob's reaction when I go, and you'll be in the show notes, and he's like, wait, what? Oh, right, yeah. We're recording this. This is happening. If you forget, you just have a conversation. Perfect. No, that's another one of those things that I've seen here since I've been at the school about the power of restorative practices and how they have worked, with students and also with staff. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that, is done here that is probably not done everywhere that restorative practices are used. The way it is used with staff, you know, we have a PLC that is having a dysfunction or is not accomplishing what they need to do. And I've seen that, you know, those restorative circles will be done with a PLC so that they can talk through their issues in an open way. We've done restorative circles at our leadership meetings with the leadership team and have discussed things that way. And it is a very powerful, powerful thing. In fact, at pre-planning during one of the rotations, everyone in the staff basically in small groups went through restorative circles. So it is something that is heavily believed in here by the leadership team for sure. And I believe many of the teachers are buying in as well. And I see it. I see there's a culture component to it. I think the negative thing that teachers see sometimes with restorative practices is it comes out as, well, this kid messed up in my class. And then the dean says, well, I did a restorative circle and we've dealt with it and it's addressed and blah, 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 blah. And they say, well, what was the consequence? It's like, well, you're missing the point. and without the culture side of it, without the movement and the community component, then it is just a way for kids to get out of a consequence. But if that part is in place, then students don't want to leave the community. They want to be involved in the community and they recognize that they have damaged what is a valuable to them community. And I think that's the component that is so powerful, is getting all those pieces to meld together.
Well, I think the other piece, I've been very fortunate on our leadership team here. We've had opportunity, myself and a few of the administrators, to present on the work that we've done with restorative practices at a couple different conferences. And invariably, that question always comes up of what do you do for the people who say, but you're not giving kids consequences? And one thing I always say is invite that person to participate in some restorative practices, because what you find, if you're doing it the right way with the kids and you're really using those effective affective statements and getting the kids to own how they impacted each other, that's really difficult. It's a lot harder to sit across from someone and hear how your words or actions impacted them, own that, and engage in that conversation than it is to sit at home for a day and play Xbox. And I've always thought it was strange that the kid that misbehaves, our kind of way of dealing with that is you get to stay home. I don't know about you, but kind of when I was a kid, I couldn't stand school. I wasn't exactly what you call popular. And so I was glad to stay home any chance I got. And went through a brief, rebellious spell that was literally about just trying to get out of school. You know, I wasn't really a bad kid. I liked the rules, but I didn't want to be there. And I knew if I did this, I would get to stay home. And we know in a lot of our neighborhoods and communities, we know what kind of community is waiting there to embrace that kid if we send them out of the school. And it's not the best. While it is not consequences in the traditional crime and punishment sense, it's not supposed to be. I mean, that's part of that paradigm shift, is moving away from just saying you did X, so here's Y consequence. It's now about looking at, well, it's a form of teaching. It's teaching that kid, here's why that was the wrong thing to do, so they don't do it again. And the other important thing is, you know, when we engage in restorative practices, there might still be some consequence, because there are some behaviors that we know are so egregious, you are still going to have to be suspended or given in-school suspension or what have you. So it's sometimes people think of it as a two separate things, and there is some merging of that, and so it doesn't become only the conversation. But like I said, I would invite anybody to engage in that work, because it is it's not easy to own your mistakes eye to eye with the other person you've harmed.
Yeah, absolutely. I like it. Man, good stuff. We're rolling right along. We've hit some good topics, and we got one question left. We got one more, and we're wrapping this thing up. So my last question for you is, who is the greatest teacher you have ever had?
Oh, that is a challenge. I mean, there are so many possible answers. And I'll tell all the people out there in podcast land, Brad previewed this question for me. So the whole time we've been talking, this has been churning in the back of my mind. I mean, I had the same teacher in second and fifth grade, a man named Mr. Robert Babbs, who, and I won't discuss how long ago second and fifth grade were, but it was quite a while, and he still stands out in my mind. I had some, you know, a woman by the name of Mrs. Jerry DeSantis, and a man by the name of Mr. Robert Wood that were teachers at my high school, that were hugely impactful. I've had so many amazing professors. At the risk of seeming like a complete brown noser, and I'm going to hate myself a little bit for saying this, but I have to say it because it is truly an honest answer. At this stage of my life, I would have to say my greatest teacher has been my mentor, our principal, Mr. Andrew Jackson. And I say that because I truly probably would have never gone into aspired to go into administration and aspired to become an assistant principal or principal if it wasn't for my interaction with Mr. Jackson and another gentleman by the name of Mr. Edward Jones, who was our principal previously that we worked together. So at this stage of my life, those two men significantly shaped my future, and not a day goes by that I don't do something. Well, now it's usually a day goes by, but a week or so that I don't ask for his feedback and input. And over the last couple of years out of the classroom, he has shaped so much and helped me process and learn how to do this, because anybody that's worked in a school who started as a teacher and then has transitioned out knows that when you leave the classroom, it truly is like starting a whole new career. Everything you learn by being a teacher is great for helping supporting teachers, but your day-to-day job looks nothing the same. And there are days that you will miss the safety and comfort of your four walls. Because I always say, if you're a good teacher, any good teacher knows this, that you can control that space. You have classroom management. You come in with a headache. You don't feel good. Your kids can see it on you. All of a sudden, even your worst class turns into angels because they have sympathy for you because, you know, they're decent human beings. When you leave your classroom, you never know what's going to happen.
You have control of nothing.
You are reacting, and you still have that laundry list of things you intend to get done. And then there's the umpteen fires that happen during the day that you have to go put out, and this person that you need to meet with, this, that, and the other. So it's very different, and I would not have made it through those first couple of years done as well as I think I have if not for those two gentlemen. So I owe a great deal to both of them.
Cool. Absolutely. You know, Jackson has, of course, been a guest on the show a couple times now. He was, I don't know episode numbers, but he was in a guest himself before I officially came over here. Him and I sat down and did a one-on-one, and then he was also on an episode over the summer when we recorded out at ISTE. Yeah. And then there's a hidden episode that will never be aired that was also recorded out of ISTE. I'm actually imagining clipping up pieces from that combined with the man that has had the biggest impact on me is Andrew Jackson. And that's going to be a great clip to air at a leadership meeting coming forward. So just be prepared for that. I see what you mean for sure. You know, and he's come up a couple times in this interview already, obviously, because he is both of our principals as we're here. And certainly the value of of his leadership is clear. And I've heard from parents who have said that it has been a drastic improvement, and that his influence is very well felt by the staff and the teachers and the parents and the students and everybody. I think that that's very clear. And obviously it was enough to get me to leave high school, which I said I would never do, and come back to a middle school, no less. And, everything I was concerned about coming back to a middle school is all still true. It's all still valid. But I cannot move an entire leadership team to a high school. So here I am. So that's how that goes.
I could completely relate because I had sworn through my career I would never work at middle school. It sounded terrifying. But a year before we came over, I was doing my Ed Leadership internship, and Ed Jones was my supervisor, and he delegated a lot of supervising me to Mr. Jackson. We had been working on some stuff all day. We were standing outside of my office, just talking about being a leader in education. And at that point, I think he'd been an assistant principal for 30 some odd years. That's exaggeration, but it's close to the truth. And he said, I think I might be ready to be a principal. And I said, well, Lord knows you've had enough practice. And then I told him, I said, in all seriousness, I think you're going to be a great principal. In fact, I want to work for you. Wherever it is, whatever job you have open, I'm going to come and take it. So then he told me it was out of middle school. And I used some colorful language and said, but I am a man of my word. What job opening do you have? And, of course, he said at that point, I don't know what I have open. I said, well, when you look, I said, look, I'll be a classroom teacher again. I will, you know, you need someone to sweep the floor. I'm not very good at it, but I will come and do it because he puts an emphasis on community building relationships and truly wants, as hard as the job is, teachers to enjoy what they do, and believes that the role of administrators, our job, as much as it is to coach and give feedback and fill out forms and all these other things, is to support teachers so that they can take care of our kids. I can't take care of all the students, but I can take care of a handful of teachers so that they can go take care of the kids. And I think that's a very powerful way to approach the role of being a school administrator.
Cool. Well, we got a little bonus answer on the end there, so I like it. I like it. Bob, we're running on almost an hour, 45 minutes now, 46 minutes. So time flies, right?
Good grief, it does. Are you really?
Dead serious, yeah.
Seems like we've been here for like 10 minutes.
Yeah, it flies quick.
Just chatting with a friend.
So that's the goal of the podcast.
I'm disappointed. I was told that typically there are beverages.
There are. I don't think that would go well since we're still sitting in my classroom.
They have no idea where we are on this thing. You didn't have to divulge the truth of our location. We could have made this sound cool.
We could have.
I
don't think I'm going to be able to edit out all of the bells that went off while we tried to record. I'm going to get most of them, but I don't know about all of them. Bob, I really appreciate you taking the time to sit down and talk with me and get this recorded. I know it was a scheduling challenge, but we got it to work. If my audience would like to reach out to you, is there any way in particular you would like to be contacted?
Sure.
Twitter, again, Facebook, wherever, any of that stuff?
I'll be honest, I'm extremely low tech. I don't tweet. I barely Facebook. I have an email. For those that still use that.
It happens sometimes.
It's drbobeducator@gmail.com. You can also send me smoke signals or carrier pigeons. I take either one of those.
Carrier pigeons. I will include that in the show notes, of course. Carrier pigeon. I don't even know where you would train. Don't you have to train them? I've never understood how carrier pigeons worked. I don't actually understand that.
You could probably ask Dr. Sam Ashley, and he could give you a lesson on carrier pigeons.
Well, now he's going to make me edit that part out of the podcast. Now his voice is online, and he's going to be convinced that means he can be found. All right. So Bob, thanks again. I really do appreciate it. I really appreciate you sitting with me, and have a great night.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Bob, thank you again for being on the show, even if your last answer did make me want to vomit in my mouth. To connect with Bob, email him at drbobeducator@gmail.com. If you have questions or comments about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter or Instagram. I'm at Brad Schreffler. Links to both of those are in the show notes. And I love to hear from you guys there. That's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Or you can check out the feedback page on my website at bradschreffler.com/feedback. Until next week, go out and speak to people.
Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio. Your voice is right here.